This is a CBC podcast. Get your daily dose of Canadian history from the CBC Digital Archives. Complete with clips from radio and television, find out what happened in the On This Day section at cbc.ca/archives.
I'm Paul Kennedy. Welcome to Ideas About Medical Screening Tests.
It's certainly been a dogma, a precept, a paradigm, whatever you want to call it, that early diagnosis is always better than late diagnosis. And of course, that paradigm is not always wrong. There's certainly many places where we'd rather see you early than late. We'd rather see you early in your heart attack than late at the first sign of pneumonia instead of when you're having great difficulty breathing. The question is, to what extent do you extend that paradigm into asymptomatic conditions?
You have no symptoms. You're asymptomatic. You have an appointment with your doctor, and she sends you for tests just because. Because you've reached a certain age, or maybe you're automatically scheduled for this test every year or every 2 years as part of your regular checkup. If you have symptoms and you go for a test, it's a diagnostic test. If you have none, it's a screening test. The common wisdom is that if we find indications of disease early, they can be treated and your life will be saved. Ergo the message, screening saves lives. Drug policy researcher Alan Castles examines this assertion in a two-part ideas series called You Are Pre-Diseased.
Whenever anyone recommends something medical, a new drug, a new test, some kind of health screen, I'm compelled to dig underneath and see if there's anything there. Maybe it's an occupational hazard, but I've grown over the years to be a little skeptical about medical matters. I'd never looked into medical screening until my own doctor started talking about a PSA test. He said I should think about it. A PSA test is a simple blood screening test. If a man has a high level of prostate-specific antigen, or PSA, in his blood, it could mean prostate cancer. Now, don't get me wrong, I care about my prostate. It's a pretty important organ. But I feel fine. Do I really need this test? Like many people, I first consult Dr. Google, then rip through some online medical journals to see if there's any proof to back up this PSA thing. And here, in my own backyard, is the provincial health officer, Dr. Perry Kendall. His job is to advise the BC government about the science of medicine in order to help them with policy decisions. I ask him to advise me.
The recommendations from the cancer agencies here are really that it should be a matter of informed consent. If you're an asymptomatic young man with no problems urinating, your prostate feels normal, then he should tell you that there is a controversy over whether the PSA test will actually prove beneficial to you. To know whether your prostate-specific antigen levels are normal is good, but they could be falsely negative. You could get a false reassurance. On the other hand, an elevated PSA test means invariably that you'll have to be followed up with some other diagnostic procedures, which may themselves cause you problems. He should also tell you that if they do find a cancer, that it doesn't necessarily tell you whether that cancer will benefit from being treated, because there are no randomized controlled trials that show that the early detection of prostate cancer actually benefits people in the long run in terms of mortality outcomes. And there are certainly downsides to being treated for prostate cancer.
A randomized trial. Now, that's a thing I know something about. It's what we researchers would call the gold standard of tests. The way it works is that you get a whole group of the same sort of people, in this case, men of a certain age, and you randomly assign some of them to get the screen and some of them to carry on with care as usual. Then you follow them. You follow them sometimes for years and see how they do. Did the screening find more cancer than ordinary care? Did the ones who were screened have more surgeries? Did they have more or fewer side effects? Did they live longer? In the case of PSA screening, we're still waiting for the results. It can be difficult to translate the statistical results of a large randomized trial into a common-sense discussion of potential benefits and harms. Dr. Kendall understands the position of a doctor trying to explain the science in a meaningful way to one patient.
I think from a physician's or a urologist's perspective, when you're looking at the one patient who's in front of you, downsides are immaterial. You want to do everything possible for your particular patient. But for asymptomatic men, you look at it from population base and say you have no evidence this is going to benefit asymptomatic men in the long run, hundreds of thousands of them. They may end up some of them will go through procedures that they wouldn't have necessarily gone through otherwise for no benefit. Mm. Could be impotence, could be urinary incontinence, very rarely death as a result of the treatment. You know, and again, you're faced with one patient in front of you. I think you have a different ethical set of decision-making than somebody who's trying to look at a population base.
Here's the problem. According to Dr. Charles Ludgate, we're thinking about a single screening test as a method of early detection, and it's only part of the story. Dr. Ludgate is a radiation oncologist with the BC Cancer Agency. He believes that all men over 50 should have an annual PSA test, and that men with family histories of prostate cancer should start sooner. But it's not quite as simple as taking a blood test and reading the PSA level.
Epithelial cells, so the PSA with age gradually goes up. If you've got a cancer, then the cancer has a doubling time depending on how aggressive it is. And so the PSA, instead of going up slowly and gradually on a constant rise, is on an exponential, so that whatever the doubling time of your particular cancer is, it would go from, say, a PSA of 4 to 8 to 16 to 32 to 64, and you'd wish it was your bank account. It gets up very high to thousands very quickly. So that the PSA is a valuable tool in telling you how your particular cancer is behaving, how aggressive it is, but it's one test. So that if you have an infection that could increase your blood supply or block ducts, then the normal prostate can give you PSA. So you can have an erroneous rise in your PSA. Normally with infection, with antibiotics, it would come down again. Some families have higher PSAs than others, so that the actual PSA level isn't very important. It's what's happening to that level over time.
So one blood test doesn't give enough information, but the results of one blood test start a cascade of activity. Back to the internet, where I find that Dr. Gilbert Welch has compiled a great deal of research on cancer screening in his book, Should I Be Tested for Cancer? Maybe Not, and Here's Why. Dr. Welch agrees to speak to me from a studio in Bozeman, Montana.
If you look at the number of men diagnosed with prostate cancer in this country, in the United States, it is remarkable what that test did to the number of cancers found. It just skyrocketed. And urologists and I have estimated that about 1 million extra men have been diagnosed with prostate cancer who would not otherwise have been were it not for PSA screening. Most people for whom we're screening for prostate cancer who have a high PSA have no palpable, that is, anything you can feel, no palpable mass on their prostate.
Right.
And even when you put an ultrasound on the prostate, you don't see anything to biopsy. So instead, the doctors sample the prostate. And just to give you some sense, the prostate's an organ about the size of a golf ball. and they put needles into that golf ball. It's sort of to systematically sample it, you know, two up high, two in the middle, two down low. And they're taking out samples that are the size of a wood splinter, basically. One of the things that has been studied, and to me this is it's sort of a no surprise, but it's really interesting, is your chance of finding prostate cancer is directly related to how many times you put the needle in the prostate.
I see.
If you put it in six times, you'll find 20% of men, say. You put it in 12 times, you'll find 40% of men. And it's a pretty consistent relationship. The more times you biopsy, the more likely you are to have prostate cancer found.
And if you find more cancer, Dr. Charles Ludgate predicts pretty much exactly what most of us would do.
If Alan Castles came to me and wisely had had his PSA done, and it was 20 or 15 or something, he would look it up in the internet, he would get extremely worried, he would probably have a biopsy, and he would probably find he'd got prostate cancer. Now, from a screening perspective, I've now lost Alan Castles because I don't have serial PSAs on him anymore. And that's where maybe there's a bit of art to look at a cancer in sequence. Over time, cancers get bigger, they grow. So your doctor will be able to feel it growing, and you'll be able to see your PSA rising. And the rate of rise and how fast it's growing gives you an idea of what's going on. So that you've got to identify not only whether you have or have not got cancer, which is the screening question, but once you've actually made that diagnosis, you've actually got to then, say, get the right treatment, or no treatment at all, just watch for waiting.
I have quite a high tolerance for ambiguity, so maybe I'm capable of watching to see how quickly my cancer grows. Just saying that out loud makes me realize how difficult that would be. Dr. Gilbert Welch believes that's partly because we have a very black and white idea of what cancer is.
I think when the word cancer is uttered, everything changes. I mean, the public's understanding of the word cancer is the same thing you'll see in my medical dictionary, which is, you know, a disease the natural course of which is death. And if that's the definition of cancer, well, you're right. I want something done with it. You know, if it's not intervened on, I'm going to die. Now, it is only because of screening that we realize that's an incredibly narrow definition of cancer. There is a whole bunch of heterogeneity out there. Yes, there are forms that grow very quickly and lead to death and can lead to horrible deaths. But there are also other forms that meet the cellular definition of cancer but grow very slowly and may never grow to cause symptoms before the patient dies of other causes. And then, to make things even more difficult, there's another set of cancers. Those are the ones that meet the pathologic definition of cancer, have abnormal cells, but in fact don't grow at all, or grow a little bit and then regress a little bit as the body begins to react to it. And it's that heterogeneity that's only become clear as we look for really early forms of cancer.
Now I'm starting to see what could happen. I have a PSA test, it's high, I get a biopsy, I have a diagnosis of cancer, and I want it out right now. This sounds like one of the potential downsides to screening. Back to Dr. Google, where I find a cancer expert who works at the National Institutes of Health in Washington, D.C., who counsels people on the potential harms due to cancer screening. Dr. Barnett Kramer explains what some of those downsides might be.
There are several harms. Number one, the most common are false positives. That is, a positive test when the person doesn't have cancer. Nevertheless, whenever someone has a positive test for cancer, it creates a great deal of anxiety and fear. and will trigger a number of other investigations, some of which are actually invasive, and some people have been known to die of major chest operations because a nodule was noted on a spiral CT looking for lung cancer. The nodule turned out to be benign, but nevertheless the person was harmed or even died from the major operation. So probably the most common harm is a false positive test. A far less common, but perhaps worse harm, is called overdiagnosis. That is, the more sensitive test you have, the more likely you are to pick up a cancer that never would have caused death in that person. And it can be a very, very slow-growing cancer that never would have come to medical attention had it not been for the screening test in the normal lifespan of that person. A classic, everyone has come to accept this as a pretty common problem, is screening with PSA for prostate cancer. The older a man grows, the more likely he is to have a silent prostate cancer. Some people would even say that once men reach the age of 60 or 70, a majority of them will have prostate cancer if you look carefully enough. But that has led to the common clinical saw that many more men die with prostate cancer than die of prostate cancer. And so in that case, there is a substantial risk that if you diagnose all the prostate cancers that are out there and apply the rather toxic therapies, you can harm many more men than you benefit.
When Dr. Kramer talks about overdiagnosis, it rings a bell with me. It sounds to me that he's describing the discovery of what Gilbert Welch refers to as pseudo-disease. I asked Dr. Welch to explain the concept of pseudo-disease to me.
Well, let me just start with the idea that there is a vast reservoir of abnormalities in normal people. Whenever we scan people who are healthy carefully, we recognize that a lot of them harbor abnormalities. Some of those abnormalities will go on to produce clinical disease. Other of them will not. Never in the lifetime of the patient will they go on to create any disease. It is that category that becomes labeled as pseudo-disease, literally false disease. And since disease is something that a patient experiences, I think that's a pretty good label for it. The typical sort of generic term for these things would be nodules. Nodules found on x-rays or CT scans in the lungs or the liver or the colon, etc. This is really the cancer that I call sort of the poster child for overdiagnosis. It is the cancer that most physicians would understand there's two sides to the story of looking for prostate cancer early.
The logical extension of overdiagnosis is overtreatment. Unfortunately, we don't know how many people are treated who need not be because once the treatment is done, there's no going back to question whether or not the cancer would have killed you. And just because PSA is the poster child for overdiagnosis doesn't mean it's the only controversial screening test.
What is less well understood is what we've learned about prostate cancer really does apply to other cancers, to breast cancer, to lung cancer, to melanoma, to thyroid cancer. That's where the physician community hasn't quite understood that the basic lessons we're learning in prostate cancer really apply to other cancers. There is no screening test that is better studied than mammography. Worldwide, about 500,000 women have been randomized. That, again, is our best medical study where we're doing a true experiment. So this has been a very carefully studied screening test, and yet there's still a lot of debate about how much or in some areas whether there's any benefit to screening. So this shows you, one thing that I think is important for everyone to understand. This is the best studied screening test. Over 500,000 women have participated in randomized trials, and yet we're still not sure.
Well, that's a bit of a bombshell. Even mammography? I thought mammography was completely uncontroversial. Luckily for us, one of the most well-known gold standard randomized trials of screening mammography was conducted in Canada by Dr. Cornelia Baines. I met Dr. Baines in Toronto and asked her to tell me about how the study was conducted and what it found.
I think it's useful to know that the whole design of the Canadian National Breast Screening Study began in the United States in the 1970s when the American Cancer Society and the National Cancer Institute of the United States decided a trial had to be done to build on what was already known. And what was already known at that point was that screening reduced breast cancer deaths in women age 50 and over, but not in women under age 50. So the question for women age 40 to 49 was, does screening reduce deaths, period, full stop? And the reason for doing the study for women in their 50s was to find out what was the incremental benefit of mammography over and above clinical breast exam. So for women 50 and over, we looked at mammography plus clinical breast exam versus in the controls clinical breast exam only. In women under the age of 50, we looked at combined screening, mammography, and clinical breast exam versus nothing. However, we couldn't bring women in to be randomized and tell them, oh, you've been randomized to receive nothing. Go home. We're not going to do anything for you. So as a compromise, we agreed to give them a clinical breast exam and then tell them, goodbye, you're not going to get any more screening.
So you enrolled these 90,000 women and then you followed them for how long?
Oh, well, they theoretically could be followed until death. When they signed their informed consent form, they agreed that we would be able to link the data that we had to the National Mortality Database. And then, knowing that they have died, you also can find out what they died of. So the whole study was predicated on short-term annual screening, 5 or 4 annual screens, depending on when they came in the study. But thereafter, being able to link the records that we had with the National Mortality Database and be able to ascertain whether they did or did not die of breast cancer after confirming with hospital records that indeed they did have breast cancer.
And the screening was done annually?
The screening was done annually. For most people, they had 5 annual screens. About a third of the cohort had only 4 annual screens because funding terminated and we had to stop the study.
What did you find?
Well, what we found was very controversial. What we found out first, and this really disappointed people in a major way, is that we did not demonstrate a benefit from screening for women age 40 to 49. We observed after 10 or 11 years a 3% decline in mortality from breast cancer, which is not significant. And the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force found the same thing, that any decline in breast cancer mortality took an awful long time to come, was very small, and was not statistically significant. So even though the National Breast Screening Study got berated for this finding, it in fact is entirely consistent with both American and European experience. For women age 50 to 59, we did not really demonstrate a major benefit from screening. However, this can be explained by the fact that our control women, age 50 to 59, got a careful clinical breast exam, which was of a quality that probably is not available to the general population. These were trained nurses who were very conscientious. And if you look at the differences between the mammography and clinical breast exam group versus the physical examination only group, you see that mammography detected far more cancers than were detected in the clinical breast exam only group, but it didn't seem to make a difference in terms of mortality.
What were the differences in absolute terms?
These are not data that come from the National Breast Screening Study. These are data that come from screening data in general. If you look at a woman age 40 who gets screening, her risk of dying of breast cancer in the next 10 years is less than 2 per 1,000. So she has less than 2 chances per 1,000 of dying of breast cancer. What are the chances for a woman who doesn't get screening? Well, for her, the chances of dying of breast cancer are less than 2 per 1,000, an absolute difference of 0.2 per 1,000. A very, very small benefit conferred. For women age 50, an absolute difference of about 1 per 1,000. So women could say, all right, if I reduce my risk by 1 per 1,000, that's fine, so I'll go ahead and get screened. But they have to then put into the equation what are the risks associated with breast screening. And the most common and tangible risk is the risk of a false positive. And if you are a woman in your 50s and you get screened for 10 years, you have a huge risk, approaching 50%, of having a false positive, unnecessary biopsy, unnecessary anxiety. It may be a risk that women are prepared to accept. And if they are, that's fine, but they should know they have that risk.
The results of the trials for prostate cancer and lung cancer screening are not yet in. In British Columbia, a new study of colorectal screening has just begun, so those results are years down the road. Around the world, screening is being studied and the results are being published. There are very few screening tests that are unequivocal. Even so, you hear every day that early detection saves lives. Maybe it's that idea, not the screening, that needs to be examined.
I think you could say that with regard to screening, there are believers and there are agnostics. And I do believe the believers outnumber the agnostics. We have a population in North America that has really been taught to fear breast cancer and to believe that screening is the solution to their fear. By the way, I have a wonderful quote in here from Tony Miller's talk last spring. In a recent book, Raffel and Gray, 2007, both concerned about the national screening programs in the UK, have coined the term popularity paradox to cover this particular situation. Quote, "The greater the harm through overdiagnosis and overtreatment from screening, the more people there are who believe they owe their health or even their life to the program." And, of course, if you end up treating stuff that isn't lethal, you're going to have a wonderful outcome. And then people say, oh, screening is wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. So I thought that was a particularly astute observation.
You're listening to Ideas in Canada on CBC Radio 1, across North America on Sirius Satellite Radio, Channel 137, and around the world on cbc.ca. I'm Paul Kennedy. Health researcher Alan Cassels explores the controversies around cancer screening in part one of You Are Pre-Diseased.
There's good news in the fight against breast cancer. Deaths from this disease have actually declined by 20% over the past decade. Why? Because more women are going through cancer screenings, which detect the disease at its earliest and most curable stages.
Clearly, there are a lot of conversations out there, a lot of different opinions about cancer screening. But there's one thing that everyone I've spoken with agrees about. You and your doctor together should be deciding whether or not you are given any screening tests. It's a principle called informed consent. The first step toward the consent is the informed part. Doctors Lisa Schwartz and Steve Wolishin are passionate advocates for the consumer's right to be informed, rather than bombarded with persuasive messages. They just published a book called Know Your Chances: Understanding Health Statistics.
Well, I think that so much of medicine is about trade-offs and especially about decisions that you make when you're healthy. And so I think that people deserve a chance to make those decisions. But all too often, people aren't given that chance because the information that they get is either distorted or misleading or just meant to persuade them to do something. And so I think it's our goal to have people really understand what medicine can do for them and what medicine can't do for them, and so they can decide what's important to them and make decisions that are right for them.
And I just want to add that, you know, we're bombarded by, you know, TV ads, public service announcements, you know, media reports telling us about health risks and things we can do to limit those risks. And a lot of times the messages aren't very good. They're incomplete or they're misleading, and that just makes us mad. And that's really, I think, what sort of motivates a lot of our work, that a lot of people, and that includes patients, providers, journalists, policymakers, haven't really been taught to or don't know how to see through the hype and find out what information, good information, is there.
So you give a little quiz, and one says that, you know, guess what your chance of dying of colon cancer is in the next 10 years, and you give people four choices. You know, is it going to be 205 out of 1,000, 55 out of 1,000, 5, or 2? And the answer is 2. And then you use that as an example of how to frame that risk, where 2 out of 1,000 versus 998 of 1,000 who won't die.
So you're saying the exact same thing, right? You're giving exactly the same information, but you're saying it in a different way. And it makes a big difference on how people hear it and how it feels. I mean,
right. And we sort of say it's like seeing the glass half empty or half full, and that they do really feel different. And whenever we present this, you know, people always laugh.
You know, 998 out of 1,000 won't die sounds so much better than 2 will die. So it's important. I mean, to be perfectly serious, though, no one knows the best way to frame the information. Like, what's the which of those two ways is better? So what we recommend is that people at least remind their audience that there are more than one way to say the same thing, and let them hear it in different ways, just to sort of take away that. It's called the framing effect, so that they can sort of get beyond whatever the sort of emotional impact of the numbers in one particular way and kind of get at the content, so they can focus on that and then kind of put it in context and decide whether they want to act on it.
Right. I think that's what underpins a lot of the enthusiasm for screening, is that the risk of not getting screened is framed in a particular way.
Right. I mean, I think in general, these messages make you feel like the threat or the risk must be enormous, and that the benefit of the test and taking away that risk is also enormous. And, you know, that's, I think, the sort of exaggerated beliefs that come out of many of these messages.
The book Know Your Chances describes a number of ways to communicate health information, specifically quantifying the risk that you will die of a particular life-threatening disease.
So we think that the most useful messages about risk have to address two things. One is to communicate how big the risk is, and then how does this risk compare to other risks, so you have some context. There was a FDA press release announcing the approval of the cervical cancer vaccine a couple years ago, and it said 3,700 deaths are attributable to cervical cancer each year in the United States. And then in the same about the same time, there was an advocacy group website that had a message about prostate cancer, and they said, in 2007, more than 27,000 men will die from the disease. So both of these messages use a common tactic. They use a large number to capture the audience's attention, but they don't provide a complete statement of risk. They don't tell you what's your chance of having this problem happen to you in a reasonable amount of time. And they also don't help you put it in context by saying, how do these problems compare to other health risks that you might face? So in order to solve this problem, we developed these things called risk charts, which are in the book as well. And these risk charts, there are four charts for men and women, smokers, current smokers, and never smokers. And what the charts do is they just say at different ages, looking at common causes of death, what's the chance of dying from these different things over the next 10 years? So, for example, like a 55-year-old man who smokes, has their 10-year risk of dying from all causes combined is about 180 out of 1,000. And if you look at the charts, you could see, comparing with the non-smoker chart, it's as if he were 10 years older. So in other words, a 55-year-old smoker has the same chance of dying in the next 10 years as a 65-year-old non-smoker. So that's sort of a way of helping people, you know, get some sense of what their overall risk is, and also a sense, for smokers anyway, of one thing that they could do to try to limit that risk. So back to the other example. So when you hear this thing about the cervical cancer vaccine or the prostate, you know, cancer screening and how many men die, you can look at these charts and you can say, okay, let's say I'm a 50-year-old man. What's my chance of dying of prostate cancer in the next 10 years? It's about 1 in 1,000. If you're 65 years old, it's about 6 in 1,000. So you can say to yourself, does that seem like a big risk? If it seems big, is it big enough to get the screening test, whatever the downsides of screening are? And you can make a rational decision. You might say, oh, it's not worth it, or, you know, it is worth it. And you can compare it to other things, like what's my chance of dying from heart disease or other things. For women, the cervical cancer risk at all ages, the 10-year risk is less than 1 in 1,000, and so that may change someone's enthusiasm for the vaccine if they see that information.
And they need to know that information before they make a rational decision. You would propose that without knowing what your risk is to start with, you can't really make a rational choice around doing something to reduce the risk.
Right, because I think that people are used to not seeing numbers. They're just used to hearing scary messages. And I think without seeing the numbers, you don't really even have a chance to make that judgment about whether this is important to you or not. But the flip side of that is because people don't see the numbers very often, they may discount small numbers. And so that's why you need some benchmarks to compare it to. Okay, well, so prostate cancer is 6 out of 1,000. Well, maybe if I see how that compares to heart disease for me, then I can get some sense of whether that's big or small. And so I think that you really do need the numbers to understand what they mean to have a chance at making that judgment, which you just can't do without the numbers.
As Lisa Schwartz says, people sometimes discount small numbers. So 5 people per 1,000 are diagnosed early. That doesn't sound like many, right? Unless I'm one of them. On the other hand, you need absolute numbers. There's a lot more impact to say that the survival rate has been increased by 30% than to say that the mortality rate has been reduced from 3 per 1,000 to 2 per 1,000. There's always the danger of bias in interpreting numbers, and a good researcher or critic knows where those biases are. Dr. Barnett Kramer from the U.S. National Institutes of Health has a colorful metaphor involving the cartoon character Dudley Do-Right for what is known as lead time bias.
Yes, I like to say that this is Canadian data because it comes from the Mounted Police, but I have a cartoon which shows Snidely Whiplash tying down his victim on the railroad tracks. And, of course, when the 5 o'clock train comes through, it's going to kill the victim. But if you develop a new early diagnostic test, such as binoculars, then the victim can make an earlier diagnosis of train, but it doesn't change the instant of impact. And that is known medically as lead time bias. That is, you may advance the date of diagnosis, but if you don't change the date of death, then any perceived benefit is actually an artifact. That is, since we start measuring survival from any cancer from the day of diagnosis, you can advance the date of diagnosis with an early detection tool without actually changing life expectancy.
Right. Pushing that analogy further, if you saw the train coming earlier, then you could alert Dudley Do-Right to come to the rescue faster.
That's right. So that is the theoretical benefit. And so if you have an effective intervention, then you might be able to change the ultimate outcome. But it's not always clear that a screening test will allow you to do that. And that's why you have to study any new screening test very carefully.
The advocates for screening often use the 5-year survival rate as a way to demonstrate the success of screening. Basically, they're saying, with all the screening we're doing, a huge percentage of people are living longer. But the 5-year survival statistic is misleading, and it drives people like Gilbert Welch nuts. So I ask him why, in his book, Should I Be Tested for Cancer, he goes to war with the concept.
The 5-year survival rate is sort of the standard measure of cancer success that people understand. And it's a very basic number. It says what proportion of patients are alive 5 years following diagnosis. And the presumption is that if a 5-year survival rate is going up, fewer people are dying. And that's a good thing. So the rising 5-year survival rates are a good thing. That, in fact, is not true. Sometimes it's true, but sometimes it's not true. In fact, all cancers in the U.S., the 5-year survival rate is going up, but that doesn't mean fewer people are dying of the cancer. What throws this statistic off is really two things. The timing of diagnosis is one. So imagine, if you will, a man who's diagnosed with prostate cancer at age 75.
Right.
And if he dies at age 79... he hasn't survived 5 years, so he contributes a 0% to the 5-year survival rate. But now let's say I diagnose him at age 73, and he dies at age 79. Well, now he's survived 6 years, and so his 5-year survival rate's 100%. But has anything changed? No. In both cases, he died at age 79. The only thing that changed was the time of diagnosis. So 5-year survival rates will go up if we advance the time of diagnosis, even if we don't delay anyone's death. So that's the first problem. It's called the lead time bias. Now, the second problem is the pseudodisease problem. And the way I've come to describe this is to imagine that the easiest way to raise 5-year survival rates in Canada would be simply to tell every Canadian they had cancer. Right? And put them in the statistic, right? The 5-year survival rate would be very high. Right? It'd be very high because most of those people will survive 5 years. So that's the problem. If you include people who were never going to die from their cancer, 5-year survival rates skyrocket. And if you have a broader calculation that includes all bad cancers and all these pseudo-disease cancers, 5-year survival rates will go up simply because you added these people who are going to survive anyway. So the real calculation to follow in terms of our success against cancer isn't the survival rate. It's the question about what the mortality rate or the death rate from cancer is. And falling death rates are a good measure of progress.
That's a gem for the memory bank. Don't think of survival. Think of the death rate. What becomes more difficult to discover is why a death rate is falling.
Screening proponents would like to tell you because it's because of screening. But there's something else doctors do, and that's treatment. And treatments change. Better treatment will lead to lower mortality rates. And then there's one other thing that happens that is never thought about very carefully, but patients may be more aware about coming to see their doctor early when something is wrong. That's not screening. That's about coming to the doctor early when something's wrong. And I think that's very much happened in breast cancer, that women in the 60s were not particularly aware of this disease. Betty Ford, our president's wife, got breast cancer in 1974. It was a public discussion about breast cancer. All of a sudden, breast cancer became a topic that came out of the closet. Women became much more aware, and they recognized if they had a new lump in their breast, they ought to come get it checked out. And that, I believe, has also helped lower our mortality rate from breast cancer.
Still, despite the difficulties and potential misuses of screening tests, orders for them continue unabated. Maybe it's not from enthusiasm so much as a need to do everything possible to make an early diagnosis. The most powerful incentive to order a test is being face-to-face with an anxious patient. Dr. Gilbert Welch thinks that the paradigm that it's better to find disease early is hard to dismiss.
But there are other more insidious forces at work as well. One has been our, and this is sort of paradoxical, but has been our drive to sort of develop measures of quality of healthcare. And these are sort of, Bill Clinton called them report cards. We're looking for ways to measure doctors. And it turns out it's really hard to measure the quality of a doctor in terms of taking care of a really sick patient. You know, every sick patient's a little different, and sicker patients aren't going to do as well as healthy ones, and maybe some doctors have sicker patients than average. And it turns out to be really hard to measure how well a doctor takes care of a sick patient. But an idiot can measure whether a doctor's giving a woman a mammogram. That's an easy thing to measure. Right. So screening tests have become a very standard measure of physician performance. To me, this is an embarrassment. I mean, if the best way to make a judgment about a healthcare plan is whether they're giving all their women mammograms, we've really lost something important about medicine. The real question about who's doing good medical care is who takes good care of sick patients. That's the way doctors should be judged.
Another pressure, perhaps more common in the United States, but something that increasingly worries doctors in Canada, is the threat of litigation.
You never see physicians being sued for overdiagnosis. That doesn't happen. They're only punished for underdiagnosis, and all of us know that. We're not stupid. And so there is a very powerful incentive to always want to test. And that's created a problem, because the more we test, the more surprise and ambiguous abnormalities we find, and so forth. So there is a very strong bias, if you will, when in doubt, to do a test.
Then there's the time issue. I tell Dr. Kramer that where I live, the average visit with a physician is probably under 15 minutes. I mean, how much time do we actually have to talk to our doctors about all the finer points of screening?
That's a very good point. Physicians in general have only a limited amount of time to talk to their patients about important health issues. And especially if a patient comes in with the common strong intuition that screening must be good for you, it takes a very, very long time for a physician to go through all the issues. And often, unfortunately, it's a lot easier to simply send a patient off for a screening test than it is to go through all the painful detail about what is known regarding the benefits and harms.
If we are going to be able to participate in a discussion with the doctor about screening when it's offered, Dr. Welch has three basic questions we can ask.
So the first question I'd ask is, why are you suggesting the test? And the reason is just to see whether there's some external force influencing the doctor, or whether he or she honestly believes it's the right thing to do. And here I'm trying to get at whether there's any measurement in the organization that is sort of pushing the doctor to do the test. And I think that's just an important thing for people to know.
Right.
The second question I suggest to ask is, are there any randomized trials of this test? And as I suggested before, the randomized trial is our gold standard way of learning about the net effect of screening. And I think in most cases, in fact, outside of colon cancer and breast cancer screening, the answer is going to be no. That may change, of course, with time, so you always want to ask that question. But you want to find out if there is randomized trial data and what it shows, so you have some sense of what you can expect on balance from the test. And the third question I suggest you ask is, what will we do if the test is positive? And that's a really very important question to ask about any diagnostic test, because if you don't like what happens when the test is positive, you might really seriously, if you don't want to do it no matter what, if the test is positive, you might ask yourself, should I have the test at all? Because all it's going to do is make you worry. So if, for example, you were a man who decided, you know, there's no way I'd have a radical prostatectomy no matter what, there's absolutely no reason to get a PSA screening test.
Let's take inventory of what we've found on this hunt for pre-disease. We found a few gems. We've learned that a number of screening tests we use to seek out pre-disease have some significant drawbacks. we found that most of us have abnormalities, and that if we hunt hard enough for pre-disease in otherwise healthy people, we're going to find it. We found that legal and medical systems may be pushing our doctors to recommend screening, and that many of us actively seek out screening just to get the certain peace of mind it might afford. Now back to where I started this journey, the PSA test for prostate cancer. I'm asking myself if I have a good reason to start testing. I'm not 50 years old yet, I've got no symptoms, and I've got no family history. Call it the healthy researcher bias, but for now, I'm going to pass. I'm sure if I had so much as a minute lump or bump, I'd be running to my doctor for a test. So I guess I come back to what makes the most sense to me. What do the facts say? Well, not enough, really. We don't know all the facts, and what we do know does not come out very strongly in favor of screening. At the very least, it's controversial. But Dr. Kramer reminds me that when humans make decisions, science often takes a backseat to belief.
There's a very strong element of intuition involved in screening because of the mantra that if you can catch cancer early, you can cure it. And that's a powerful intuition, and that is an intuition that not only lends itself to sound bites, but it lends itself to the pre-existing belief systems out in the public.
Right. It's basically the common sense paradigm that, yeah, you might as well not wait until you get the cancer. You want to find it before it does anything to you.
Yes, and it almost seems to clash with all common sense that screening tests can actually have a harm and that there is actually a controversy surrounding many commonly available screening tests.
So maybe we need new common sense.
That's exactly right. I think that for many, many years, perhaps the health professions have been overly successful in getting across the concept that early detection must be good for you. And sometimes our public health campaigns have been launched without all the evidence that we might need, and often the goal is to get people to do what you want them to do rather than to give them the full flavor of the balances of benefits and harms.
On Ideas, you've been listening to part one of You Are Pre-Diseased, prepared and presented by Alan Castles. Next week, in part two, Alan ventures out to the world's biggest medical convention, and he discovers where medicine and the market meet. The series was produced in Vancouver by Kathleen Flaherty. Special thanks to Amanda Heffelfinger and Jacqueline Van Wiltenberg. For more information about this or any other Ideas program, or to sign up for our weekly newsletter, please visit cbc.ca/ideas. The executive producer of Ideas is Bernie Lucht. I'm Paul Kennedy.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.